floor with guaranteed livable income. I'm Kathy Russell Duggan.
And I'm Isaac Mundy. And we're really excited to have our second episode of Glee Club. And if you're wondering about the name, Glee Club comes from GLI, Guaranteed Livable Income. And we're talking about this because over the last little while, well, it's been more than the last little while. The United Church, over a number of decades, has been advocating for the possibility of introducing a guaranteed livable income. But there really is a push on right now in our denomination, and we really feel like the time is ripe. We've had great messages from our moderator and from other key figures in our church. And basically what a guaranteed livable income is a government public program with a regular payment delivered to all citizens below a certain income level without a work requirement. And this week, we're really excited to be welcoming Reverend Ed Bentley, who is a minister in our area, because Reverend Kathy is at Bloomfield United Church, and I'm here at Trenton United Church. And Ed lives in our region, has done amazing work. He was the minister at Eastminster United Church in Belleville for a number of decades. They are known for their open door program in terms of a meal program, working with folks who are vulnerable in the Belleville community. But Reverend Ed has also been an amazing advocate for towards working for folks and with folks who are living in poverty in our region. And he was instrumental in the work of the Poverty Roundtable in Belleville and has really been an inspiration for lots of folks like Kathy and I as we work towards being a part of this advocacy work of the United Church. And Kathy, maybe you can say a bit more about what you were interested in terms of connecting with Ed for this particular interview.
Well, Ed and I were colleagues in Belleville, and I've always had tremendous respect for him and for his leadership. And when we first started planning out this podcast, Isaac, what really sealed the deal for me was you sent me a sermon of Ed's that you had, that he actually preached under the Mike Harris government in Ontario, when that government was slashing social assistance payments and bringing in the requirement of workfare. And I read that sermon with great interest, and it was really a no-holds-barred, very faithful, very passionately and reasonably argued, full-throated objection to the Harris government policies around social assistance in our province. I think the closing words of that sermon, in fact, were, "This is wrong." And you know, based on that, I thought, well, we really need to speak to Ed and get his take on guaranteed livable income, given that he's been such a long time and faithful advocate for, as you say, and with marginalized people living in low income areas. And and we know that, of course, there are lots of folks across our church, our denomination, who are involved in that kind of work and have been for decades. And certainly, I think Ed represents the best of that impulse to connect the life of faith and you know, building the kind of world, the kind of community that God calls us to and that we see articulated and embodied in the ministry of Jesus. So, I don't know, are we ready to listen to my conversation?
Yeah,
with Ed?
Let's have a listen. I'm really excited.
All right.
Let's take a listen now.
Fantastic. Ed, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you. Great to have a chat.
Yes, we're delighted that you're able to speak to us. lots of people still think, and some even in the church, that church life and the spiritual world and the world of politics and public policy really don't have anything to do with each other, or shouldn't have anything to do with each other. How do you respond when people question the church's right to speak about issues in our world?
Well, I know that's true. And often hear that from people within the church. There are lots of folk in every area of the church for whom spiritual life, their faith, is not connected, or if it is connected with the world outside of things that are more obviously faith related, those connections are almost tangential and very specific, and ultimately they seem to be self-serving. And when I hear it, it always amazes me, and I try not to suggest any motive for the attitude, but I don't know how somebody who purports to be a disciple of Jesus, as Jesus is revealed in Scripture at least, or presumes to hold to a faith that has its roots in part at least in the Hebrew tradition, the prophetic tradition, who can imagine that disconnect. I could spend the next couple of hours just citing Scripture, showing off. I probably couldn't, but I can say I could. All the biblical references, the prophetic literature about the calls to justice, and the indictment of leadership and people where justice didn't exist. And of course, Jesus again and again and again calls on his followers to recognize the needs of the poor. We have a long history of watering down that portion of the message. I think in the Beatitudes, we like to say, for instance, yeah, blessed are the poor in spirit, because that includes me. That includes me as I wallow in my prosperity. But I'm included. I'm blessed because I've got lots of money, great place to live. But I'm poor in spirit. So yeah, Jesus loves me too. So you've got the biblical roots, which I don't know how anybody could deny. As United Church people, we have our history. Social justice is, people would talk about the New Democratic Party, a couple of generations ago as being the United Church being the NDP in prayer, the great movements that have created universal pension, universal health care, and so on, have so much of their origin in the preaching traditions, particularly of Western Canada. The United Church came out of that in large measure. I remember when I was in seminary, we'd have, I think Clark MacDonald was then the secretary for Division of Mission in Canada, I think. And I looked to him as a kind of model of what we once were, because he would be preaching at a church on a Sunday night and preaching conversion, preaching commitment, preaching personal relationship with God. And Monday afternoon, he'd be leading a gang on University Avenue in downtown Toronto, picketing the American Embassy about the grape farmers in California or the war in Vietnam or something. There was no disconnect between the evangelism of word and evangelism of action. We seem to have lost that, where we feel that there's a choice. So we've got our own tradition that so much of the current reality seems to belie, and that question belies it. But there's another thing that I've been made aware of by people who have challenged me as, you know, being a mainline middle class, very white, very male, very privileged order of ministry person. And that is, and it's obvious when you think about it, if as a church, we don't speak up on matters of particularly social justice, especially poverty, if we don't speak up because we are seen as the, and we are the establishment church to the extent that one exists anymore, then what we're doing is we're giving tacit endorsement of the policies, of the politics that perpetuate the social injustice. We don't have the choice to remain silent because our silence is legitimizing such a range of suffering.
You said that you have, you could quote for hours scripture that in that prophetic tradition. Do you have a particular favorite? One that I came across recently is the whole chapter of Isaiah 58, which is a no holds barred call to prophetic justice. And you know, God says, "You think I care about your fasts and your, you know, and your offerings? This is the fast that I want, that you would actually do justice and care for the poor." And this wonderful phrase that's really in the New International Version, actually, is if you will spend yourself in behalf of the poor, then your light will shine like the noonday. And I was sure that must be a mistake. In behalf of, I'd never heard that phrase of before. And I looked it up, and there's a difference between on behalf of, which means in place of. But in behalf of has this sense of alongside, right? Yeah. In conjunction with. And I love the image, the economic image of, you know, spend yourself in behalf of the poor. So that's become a favorite of mine. Do you have one that comes readily to mind?
Oh, I important. It's great preaching stuff. I hate and despise your feasts and all of that, and let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like. But I think my favorite, but the one that resonates for me, I keep coming back to, and I think it's because of how Jesus used it, is Isaiah 61, I think, which is the mandate that when Jesus stood up and said, "This is why I'm here. I'm here. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, for God has anointed me to do five things." Quoting Isaiah, and those five things, and we know that he ticked off the people who were, I mean, they ran him out of town afterwards, according to the story, and I think we can imagine that, because people do not like to be challenged. The mandate, the bring good news to the poor. Well, of course, it's the good news is the message of hope. There is no hope when people are caught in circumstances over which they have no control. Hope is the absence of control. It's powerlessness, it's helplessness that destroy hope. And so it's the mandate that Jesus called, gave himself, adopted, and surely as the body of Christ, it is ours. And each step of that, the recovery of sight to the blind, which I think is usually extended to be a ministry of healing more generally. And we know that you just look at the statistics and that people who are economically the economic underclass, as they are sometimes called, that their healthcare challenges are greater for obvious reasons. I mean, all you got to do is go into Walmart, for heaven's sakes, and look at what's on sale. And I was amazed at a grocery store. Just inside the door, there were pies. Never seen pies so big, apple pies, so big. They must have been 18 inches across for $10. Oh my goodness, $10 for an apple pie, which, as you know, the way they're made, it's mostly fat and sugar. And less than 3 meters away was the stand with the peppers, the yellow and green and red pepper packages, and three little peppers were $4.50. So it means we know that and the connection between poverty and health, and oppression, called to stand for the oppressed, to stand with the oppressed. I mean, it's all about, and many other things, of course. Jesus convicts us in every aspect of our lives, but poverty. And then, of course, the fifth element of the mandate, to declare that this is the year of the Lord, which is the call to immediacy. And anybody who thinks, well, you know, when Jesus comes back and God fixes everything, oh, the poor are going to be fine. Just wait. You're going to see. It's going to be so nice. When we're convicted by this call, this is the immediacy, is to do it now.
Yeah.
So anyways, there's lots. And absolutely. I'm not going to go on for 2 hours because that would be
anybody, Kathy. I was thinking about, Isaac had sent me one of your sermons from way back when workfare was coming in, and certainly you were very prophetic in that sermon, and very rightly so. I remember being in Toronto and going to the Days of Action in Queen's Park and so on and so forth. And one of the things that you mentioned in that sermon was the need for a new Protestant work ethic. And so I wondered if you could talk just a little bit about what did you mean by that, and how do you see it connecting to supporting a program like Guaranteed Livable Income?
Well, going back to and I think one of the things that should and I think it does convict all of us is how many of the Harris government policies continue, and how many, just for instance, the slashing of social assistance payments, whatever government since, we've never come back to where we were before he did that. And it's just criminal. But what was new about workfare, was the idea of deserving, that welfare, however it may have been experienced by people, because it was never perfect, far from it, but the foundation of what had been welfare until then was that the critical what determines whether or not a person gets welfare is their need. If you don't have it, you don't have the money that you need. And because we have to keep constantly reminding ourselves that it's very simple. It's not brain surgery. There is a cure for poverty, and the cure for poverty is money. So people without enough money to buy food, to pay the rent, then they could qualify for welfare. The workfare concept is to say, no, that your entitlement is based on your deserving. Your deserving is based on what you contribute to society. So you got to do work. And if you don't have a job, we'll make you do something, whatever it is. And that's how you will qualify for what the government may give you, and that was new, and it does it. So what is it? And of course, the justification is, oh well, that's the Protestant work ethic, isn't it? I mean, that's a foundational element of our whole society, that people work to earn to get what they need. But you got to work before you get it, right? And I can imagine all the arguments around pensions when that was a new conversation. You know, whether or not there should be a guaranteed annual income for people at the end of their working life when they're not working anymore. Well, they don't deserve it, do they? They're not doing anything. They're not contributing anything. So the idea that somehow we need to earn the right to receive the basic stuff of life, enough food, a decent place to live, some measure of security, and so on. And what an aberration! And certainly, it's so inconsistent with the biblical notion. Years and years ago, I remember these things that you remember because they caused you to change your thinking. And it was some, I don't remember even who it was, but it was a Hebrew scholar who made the observation or made the point that the Hebrew concept of prosperity is very different from the modern Western one. The Hebrew concept of prosperity, there would be prosperity in the community if there was enough for everyone. It was a communal concept. We all know what prosperity means. Prosperity means you've got more than anybody else. The more you have compared to everybody else, the more you are thought to be prospering. So I think that we need that, especially when we're talking about any kind of social assistance or how we deal with the realities of the injustice regarding economic security, that what we need is a good old fashioned Hebrew concept of prosperity.
And there's the other side of that, it seems to me, is that, there's that prosperity gospel, so-called, right? The health and wealth, that the idea that if you're doing right by the Lord's going to do right by you, and that somehow your material status is directly connected to your walk with God, to your life of faith, to your commitment to the quote unquote Christian life.
Well, and but how easily we all fall into. I remember the All in the Family. There are probably some people listening who remember the old TV show.
I remember All in the Family.
Norman Lear just got another acknowledgement of his incredible contribution. But so the Archie Bunker show, and there was some, I think it was a preacher someplace in the, or a theologian in California. He created a Bible study called Archie Bunker and the Church. And it was great because Archie Bunker, he represented so much of the worst in so many of us. One of the points being made was in the study, and there's lots of evidence in the TV show, Archie Bunker created God in his own image. Mm. And constantly worshiped the God whom he created in his own image. And we all do that to some extent. You know, so that's why, for how many generations, the image of God, certainly in Western church and culture, was the old white guy, right? We create God in our understanding of what that authority figure looks like. So when we think about what is our responsibility, it's inevitable that it reflect a kind of egocentric notion. And so, what does God want? Well, God wants what's best for me. well, how do I earn that? Will I be God's good little boy or girl, and then I'll have what I want. No place in that particular series of comments or thoughts is there, well, what does God expect of me?
Right. Yeah, it's a kind of a way of affirming our own biases and as you say, our own desires right out of the gate, right? If God says it's okay, then it legitimizes all of it. And again, as you say, we avoid the whole idea of being challenged in any way. So just a couple of more questions. There's a tension also, I think, in church life, and you would have experienced this too, between the charitable model of assistance and the justice model, or at least there can be. And Evelyn Forget gave a really interesting answer to this question about charity. And she said, I actually think charity is very important because there will always be immediate needs to which we need to respond. And charities are really the ones that are best placed to respond to immediate, urgent needs, kind of emergency scenarios very often. But they are not... but justice is different. Social justice is different. It's about moving towards, it's about thinking about what kind of world do we want to live in and how do we, what are the policies and choices that we can make that get us closest to that world. So I just wonder if you could comment about if you see a tension there, or if both are important, or if we should be letting go of charity completely and just embracing social justice, or how do you see those things in relationship?
Well, we don't have that choice, because the charity or social action response to need is and I like her, I suppose. I can't imagine, certainly not in our culture, as it continues to unfold, that we'll reach the point where we don't need food programs and so on. However, the other side of that coin is we have to constantly be asking ourselves if what we do and really so easily. And with lots of pats on our back, you know, it's like you mentioned the food program, the prepared meal program at Eastminster, which continues, thank goodness. Oh my goodness, so you did it. I mean, hooray. The congregation after I left applied for some funds to upgrade their kitchen, and all the politicians were delighted to come and hand out some money, because this is such a wonderful example, without anybody asking the question, are we not that us being, well, certainly the Christian community, the faith community, are we not allowing those who could really make significant change around social justice, are we not giving them the ultimate cop-out? They don't have to. The Harris government was I guess it was an extreme example of what we see in governments, basically all governments at all levels of all political persuasion, when he said, well, you know, we got a lot of people who are hurting. And so everybody should go out and donate to your church, donate to the United Way. Oh, the United Way does great work. So you go donate to them and we'll continue to perpetuate this systemic injustice. quite a number of years ago, there was a great idea, and I think it was the Poverty Roundtable in Hastings Prince Edward. There was an organization based in Toronto called Freedom 95. And it was, and the idea of Freedom 95, you know, the spin-off Freedom 55, where financial institutions try and persuade you to get your retirement plans in order so you can retire early. So these were folk who said, for those of us who work in the social action or charity field, we would love to retire, but we're not going to be able to retire until we're at least 95 because nothing is changing. It's only getting worse. Mm-hmm. So that was a great idea. And so we organized an event which we thought we want to acknowledge all the wonderful volunteers, mostly church, but other community group volunteers who were staffing the food bank and running the prepared meal programs and doing all this wonderful work. And so we brought them together for a wonderful lunch. It was great. And we had some people from Toronto come down to talk. It was hell, absolute hell, because what the lovely folk who did all the work of charity heard was, as long as there is charity, there will be no social justice. And what we need to do is act for political change. And of course, all these poor people who went for a nice lunch to be told how great they were, heard that they were doing a terrible thing. And they went away. Oh, it was a mess that took forever to clean up. And so we take responsibility for kind of not thinking it through. But both were right. Both were right. Those people were doing and continue to do wonderful things, necessary things. But if there was the same groundswell of people who are willing to work for social justice, it would be less easy for our governments to get away with what they get away with in terms of social injustice.
Right. Yeah, there's a sense always we have to ask us who are we doing this for and why do we need to do it at all, right? So yeah, really important to foundational to keep those questions in mind and at the forefront, so that, as you say, it doesn't become self-serving primarily, so that we can feel good about ourselves and that we see the bigger picture as well. Food banks have become institutionalized, which was never the intent, I'm sure, but certainly that is the reality. And we think, I think now people feel like, oh, well, if there are hungry people, they can just go to the food bank, right? Like that's kind of the mentality. And of course, if you're desperate enough to need to go to the food bank, and whatever you're going to get, that well-meaning people have donated is, that is not the solution, and certainly not any kind of solution over any period of time.
Well, I think it's also what we lack is a willingness to ask the question, why? Mm. Why? And COVID has brought a lot of things into maybe sharper focus or turned on some lights where there had been more shadow. I think we all need to be asking ourselves why it was when the government, to its credit, responded to the crisis, the economic crisis for so many. And they decided, well, if people are thrown out of work by COVID, they need money. And what do we have to give? Well, they need $500 a week. That's CERB, right? $500 a week. So here we are responding to a crisis and we say people who have lost their income need $500 a week to get by. I wonder if those people have looked at what the social assistance rates are. It was $700 and something dollars a month in Ontario. for a single person in a community where a basic one bedroom apartment costs over $1,000 a month. It's bizarre. Nobody's asking those why questions. It's where a church that still had the energy and the credibility to provide moral leadership, that we would be asking those questions en masse. They'd be asked in every pulpit every Sunday, because we are all front row witnesses to the devastation of COVID. But all that's done is caused a whole lot of other people to be in the circumstances that so many of our neighbors have been living with, sometimes generations.
Right. And then that same assistance was not actually available to those people either.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. You're already getting $700 a month.
You're already getting $700. So you don't get to get to $2,000, which is just, well, it is. It's insult to injury, isn't it? Really. So I'm sure I'm going to need to wrap things up. Child care duties are looming for me, but I just wondered. You speak about these issues with such passion, and that's so obvious and palpable. So in your decades of ministry and caring about and preaching about and advocating around these issues, you must have encountered many people with heartbreaking, heart-wrenching stories, experiences firsthand of poverty and living with poverty and struggling with poverty. Is there a story that you could share that kind of sums up what the struggle for guaranteed livable income is really all about when you get right down to it?
Yeah. You know, it's hard. It's hard to be specific because there are so many. I was, in retrospect, for so many reasons, I was blessed when at ordination, I was sent to a community in Nova Scotia, which had at the time, apart from Indigenous communities, it had three national distinctions. The highest unemployment rate, the highest alcoholism rate, and the highest suicide rate, again, outside of Indigenous communities. And lived with that reality for 3 years. And there are many, many learnings in that. One that really was convicting was how the people in the churches I was called to serve, almost without exception, did not belong in those categories. Well, we had some substance abuse issues, but the substance abuse issues of our church people were not rooted in the poverty of their reality. So here we were, and the church became, in almost, there were five congregations, so five different communities, and the churches were almost oases in isolation of the hard reality that was going on around them. And really good people, really nice people, and there were some programs, some charity type programs. But that was a reality, and everybody took it for granted. It's just the way it is, and it struck me how, I guess it didn't strike me. I grew to feel something's really wrong here, that the church was so protected from those realities, and then I have to acknowledge, not because the people in the church were so much better, not because they worked so much harder, they're not because they were more ethical, more moral. In fact, that was so often not the case. So what was it the reality of that essential injustice, and that's been true throughout my ministry, and then becoming, I've always been active while in ministry, with particularly in areas of mental health and social justice. And of course, the connection between poverty and mental illness is so obvious, and it's profound. And if there is no other reason for exploring the guaranteed income option, then it is as a response to the public health crisis that exists in mental health. Think if you're having any issues at all with your ability to cope, and none of us is more than a circumstance or two away from that. And imagine living in poverty. Imagine living in poverty. Imagine not being able in rural Ontario, southeastern Ontario, not even being able to afford what it would take to get transported from the rural community where you live because you can't afford to live anyplace else, to the center where the mental health supports exist. You can't even get there. So it's what a vicious circle. And apart from, instead of giving you one or two specific instances, just imagine just the multitude of people for whom this is a reality, and for whom it's made worse by the fact that nobody seems to care except to throw, you know, a donation of food into the basket every now and again. That's harsh. That's harsh, but I'm old and cranky.
I think it's fair enough. It's for myself, one of the really appealing things about guaranteed livable income is its simplicity. And there are many, many complex issues facing our world that we've become, again, more aware of more recently. Racism, sexism and misogyny, prejudice across stereotypes of all kinds, and yet, and those are quite, complex, intersectionalized issues, and a guaranteed livable income doesn't solve any one of those things. But what poverty does is it exacerbates all of them. Exactly. So why not pick the low-hanging fruit, which is this is the one you could check, right, with a box, and provide people who don't have money with money, and at least take poverty out of the toxic mix that so many people are dealing with. You could remove that one element, and while it doesn't fix everything, it would surely make a difference. So, Ed, I want to thank you so much for having this conversation. I hope it felt a little bit like a conversation anyway, and for sharing your experience and your passion, which is always so clearly rooted in your faith, and not only your life as a leader in the church, but your own personal commitment to the gospel, which we're called to follow and to share. So thanks for making yourself available.
Oh, Kathy, that was such a rich conversation with Ed. Really appreciate just the different perspectives and helping to look at this topic in a new way. And, you know, as you folks were speaking, that one passage that you had brought up, it was something, I think it's a translation that I wasn't familiar with, of Isaiah 58, verse 10, but it comes from the New International Version, and I was thinking maybe I'll just read part of this passage just to bring people back into it, because I think that it really takes up some of the themes that you folks were talking about in the conversation. And so we have this message coming through in this passage: "If you spend yourselves in behalf of the hungry and satisfy the needs of the oppressed, then your light will rise in the darkness and your night will become like the noonday." And I love this imagery of spending yourself. Spending, it's not just spending, you know, kind of what you have left over or what's on the side, but really bringing your whole self to this process of caring for the neighbor, and particularly caring for the neighbor who is in need. And I know for myself in different conversations that I've had with Ed in the past, one of the things that he's brought up with me that's really powerful is the biblical concept of shalom and really the idea of the common good, and that as we draw closer to God, we automatically draw closer to one another, and that means drawing closer to those who are the most vulnerable in our world. And of course, when we're talking about guaranteed livable income, we're making sure that that having these programs in place will allow for each and every human being to have a level of dignity, but also to be able to share in the common good in ways that right now we know that's not taking place in our society. So there's just so much there to unpack and think about, but could you take us a little bit more deeply into this passage and what touches you about it?
Well, I think you're exactly right. And picking up on that, that theme that's been so important to Ed in terms of the good, really, from the perspective of Christian faith and biblical faith, is the common good. There's really not much emphasis on the individual good, as it were, on coming out on top or anything like that. It's about the good is a shared experience. It's a shared reality. And so, as Ed referred to in our conversation, prosperity is not about me being more prosperous than you. It's about it's a shared experience where prosperity means that the community, the collective, has an experience of prosperity. And I love this. I love that in this translation, the image is specifically economic, right? We're all familiar with spending. We spend money. We spend time. We spend effort, but this idea of spending yourself, like that just kind of goes to the core of who we are. Spend yourself in behalf of the hungry and satisfy the needs of the oppressed. So that, you know, that just goes so deep. It's about connecting and giving of who you are at your core. And contributing to a greater good, and as you say, specifically targeting those who are vulnerable and who find themselves marginalized and oppressed, and that the equation is, if you do that, then good things are going to happen for you. You're, again, collectively, your light, whose light, the community's light, Israel's light, your light will rise in the darkness and your night will become like the noonday. So that whatever we do on behalf of someone else, it comes back to us, right? And that, again, collectively, we grow as a community, we sustain one another, and that no one is kind of either achieving on their own as some kind of, you know, self-made, whatever that means, person, and no one gets left behind either. We're all, you know, we're all connected, and that God's really, yeah, not so interested in my personal prosperity, counter to what, you know, there's certainly voices in the Christian community, broadly speaking, who would say, no, actually, God is very invested in your personal prosperity. But as usual, you know, the Bible and the prophets act as a pretty strong corrective towards those tendencies. And certainly, I think that comes across in the conversation that Ed and I had as well.
Yeah, and you know, thinking about personal prosperity, and then even also with this passage, you know, you and I have talked about this in terms of just a few verses before, not being that interested in terms of personal piety too, that it's not just about like being able to show how good I am in terms of certain acts of piety, but taking a much broader view. And that kind of makes me think about, there were two parts in this conversation that I think it's good to be able to hold them together, because at one point Ed talked about how there was a speaker who came to an event and kind of gave a group of people a little bit of a hard time in terms of maybe wagging the finger a little bit in terms of the really meaningful work that they were doing in their community that might have been maybe more, I don't know if I would use the word grassroots or relational, but very focused on developing relationships with folks who were living in vulnerable situations. But on the other hand, Ed reminded us in another part of the conversation that it's not only about the relational or the, you know, sometimes the hands-on things that we can do can make us feel good in the moment, but we also need to think about the wider structural issues. And sometimes that means getting political. Sometimes that means being willing to speak out on certain issues. And sometimes that can be, that can make us uncomfortable. So, and with this podcast, we're hoping that people can be able to reflect more deeply on their life of faith and how that relates to guaranteed basic income. And one of the questions that we'd like to be able to ask you folks is, where right now do you feel most comfortable? Would you feel most comfortable in terms of volunteering, say, at a food bank or in a meal program? Are you more comfortable on that advocacy side of things, or working around policy? Both are important, but probably all of us have leanings in one direction or the other. And so what can be helpful is to think, okay, where do I feel most comfortable, and where can I maybe work on my growing edge in terms of moving into those other areas, so we can also have a sense of wholeness in terms of the work that we do as communities of faith, in terms of reaching out, that we're not just in one place or the other, but that we're trying to really approach this in a holistic sense. And again, thinking about the common good, wanting to look at the whole picture. So where you folks feel like you're at is basically what we're asking. And where's the room for growth?
Yeah, I think we all have room for, you know, well, of course, there's always room for growth in whatever area we're talking about. And I think one of the things Isaiah is saying in the passage, or, you know, reporting giving the prophetic voice to God's will, which is that not that piety is bad or even unimportant or even unnecessary, but it isn't very meaningful if it's not connected to a broader concern for the community and for the whole people of God, right? Which is everybody, the whole earth, in fact. So. But yeah, it's a good thing to think about where's my own comfort, and not to feel bad about that, but to say, yeah, but maybe there is another area where I can grow, because I think it is also important to remember that these policies, these issues affect real people on the ground every single day, and they live with a reality that is a result of choices and policies but it affects them in a very real, lived way, moment by moment, day after day, in terms of what they are able or not able to do. So we really need to consider both, and those folks need us to hear from them and to be in relationship with them, and we need that as well. But yeah, really important to think about that. Can I talk about the book now?
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, thinking about real people's real experiences, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the book, because we want you folks to be able to have a chance to check out different resources that are out there.
Yeah, so a new book that came out just this spring, which I think does both. It actually looks at the policy case for guaranteed livable income, but it also really embeds within its pages the real lived experience of folks who were participants of the Ontario Basic Income Pilot Project. And you will probably have heard about that and the fact that it was brought in by the previous Liberal government and then prematurely cancelled by the current Conservative government. And so Jamie Swift and Elaine Power, both out of Kingston, put together this book called The Case for Basic Income, Freedom, Security, Justice. And it really does an excellent job, as I say, of doing both, covering the policy side of things in terms of how the policy for the pilot project was developed, and the work that went into that, and then also really spotlighting the experience on the ground of those who receive that income, and then the devastating impact that they experienced when the program was prematurely canceled. And I'll just read the dedication here because I think it really says it all. So the dedication from Jamie and Elaine at the front of their book is to the 4,000 courageous people who took a chance on the Ontario Basic Income Pilot and whose good faith hopes were shattered when a progressive Conservative government arbitrarily and prematurely canceled it. So there we go, another couple of people who aren't holding back on their on their feelings about the importance of guaranteed livable income and what it means when we choose not to to support the oppressed and the hungry in these ways. So available from fine booksellers everywhere, and it's published by I think Between the Lines Press. Anyway, it's readily available. Yes, Between the Lines Press. Jamie Swift, Elaine Power, The Case for Basic Income, Freedom, Security, and Justice. So another fine resource in your bookshelf on guaranteed livable income.
Awesome. Thanks, Kathy, for sort of filling us in about that. And I think a lot of us will be excited to be delving more into that book over the next little bit. In upcoming episodes, we're going to be having more conversations. We'll be talking with several folks who have had the experience of receiving support from the current systems that are in place in Ontario. And I think it really helps us to be able to understand a bit more about the positives that are there, but also why there is a need for more in terms of a program like guaranteed livable income. We'll connect with folks who are involved in the political side of this work of advocacy for guaranteed livable income. And you folks have heard us either speaking in the last episode or mentioning Evelyn Forget, and she a lot of her research was around the MINCOM project, and so we're going to talk to some folks as well who did some great work with both with that project on the ground, but also helping to make known more about that project to the wider world.
Yeah, so we're going to talk to Ken Heichel, who was the executive director of the original MINCOM project, and also to Ken Fisher, who with Truth Be Told Films. His film company made a short documentary about that that Mincom experiment and the benefits that it had, lifelong benefits for a number of different families who took part.
So, lot to look forward to. Hope you folks have enjoyed the episode today, and have a great week.
Yep. Stay safe. God bless.